Good morning. I have the privilege of introducing someone you probably already know, even if you have never met him. If you look in the back of your program, you'll see a bio on Paul McLean. And I wanted to give you a little bit of background that you may not know about Paul. Paul started at the radio station at the University of Delaware County, or college, for station WXDR. You get extra points if you know what WXDR stood for. Do you know, anybody? It stood for, according to legend, it stood for sex, drugs, and rock and roll. What else at a college station would do that? But anyway, he said he doesn't know about those, but that led to news anchoring at Delmarva broadcast radio stations in Washington, and he later worked in equipment sales. But we are so glad, and we are so blessed to have him carry the cause for us as well. Everybody, Paul McLean.
Thank you. Thank you, Linda. You can be thankful, but I don't know about blessed. Good morning, everybody. It is a privilege to be back at the clinic. In my first full-time job at radio after the sex, drugs, and rock and roll portion, I had a sweet gig as an afternoon news anchor at WDEL in Wilmington, and it was what we called a full-service station, as most of you probably know. Local DJs, music playing on cart machines. Tons of very local news, weather, and sports in the mornings and the afternoons, and I loved it. I thought it was just what a radio station should be. I was 21 when I started at that AM station, but I noticed something that while I was busting my ass in the newsroom all day long, I would occasionally record those little news snippets for the FM up the hall, WSTW. But on the weekends, when I would go hang out with my just-graduated college friends, that was all they had heard. They were wondering, you know, what was it like working at Rock 93.7? Man, I heard you on WSCW the other day. That was so friggin' cool. That was a big deal to them. WDEL was the station their parents listened to, and that was, you know, 1983 we're talking about. So I suppose even then that I knew that AM was going to have its challenges. Rush Limbaugh came along and extended its life, but you know, the past year has really focused our attention and this industry on the challenges and future of AM. So we're going to talk about that today with our guests David Oxenford, David Layer, and Chris Tarr, whom you'll meet in a moment. Here's what we're going to do. I'll ask each to share their insights on this topic for just a few minutes, and then I get to ask questions, which is what I love to do all the time, but I would like you very much to ask questions too, and we'll have people with microphones who can catch up with you. Session's 45 minutes long. So first off, I'm going to ask David Layer to speak. Most of you know him, if nothing else from yesterday, but I just want to acknowledge him as one of the hardest working and most friendly to radio people in our industry. And if there's an important technical issue happening in radio, David probably is either following it or helping to lead on it, whether that's at the National Radio Systems Committee, the NAB Pilot Initiative, and the NAB Radio Technology Committee, or being at sessions like this. We were privileged to honor him with the Radio World Excellence in Engineering Award. So welcome again, David Layer.
Paul, thank you.
Can you speak up here?
Sure, I'll come up there.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Hi, everybody. Again, thanks for having me. If you were here yesterday, you heard me talking about AM a little bit. AM in autos is something NAB has really had its radar up on ever since car manufacturers stopped putting AM in electric vehicles. And we were, you know, we didn't like that at all. We wanted to look into it and see why they were doing it. What are the reasons? What are the remedies? And we've been working on that for a while. But then this March, things really kind of kicked up a notch when Ford came out and said, we're taking AM out of all of our cars, including gasoline-powered cars. And that's really when things started moving. That's when NAB got seriously involved. We, you know, we lobbied Capitol Hill for some legislation to mandate AM in vehicles. And in fact, where's the clicker? Here it is. You know, it's been an amazing few months. I think it's interesting to note one of the things the car makers say when they talk about taking AM out is, well, you can get the information on streaming signals. So there's no reason we can take AM out, but people can still listen to their favorite AM programs. And that may or may not be true, and depending upon where you live has a big impact on that. And of course, what we've been doing at NAB, we have this campaign where we asked people, regular, citizens, listeners, to contact Congress and explain how important AM is to them. And it's been a phenomenal campaign. And it's, I'd say, by a factor of 10, garnered more responses than any other campaign we've ever done. I think at this point, there's been about 300,000 individuals reaching out to the government and saying, no, we want you to keep AM. And for broadcasters, hopefully you've been to this website. NAB has spots which we've produced, which you can run on the air, and asking people to contact their congressman or congresswoman and just speak up on how important AM is to them. So one of the things we did, we found that in talking to people about how important AM is, of course, we focus on the emergency alerting aspects of AM radio. And there's really two components to that. There's the primary entry point, which we're going to hear about here in just a second, and then there's just the ability for AM to reach listeners. And we created a map showing that AM has phenomenal coverage during the day. It's even better at night. And people talk about using FM as a replacement for the emergency alerting aspects, but when you talk about the primary entry point portion of that, for example, you would need hundreds more stations than are currently used on AM to fulfill the same function. Let me talk just for a moment about PEP stations, the primary entry point stations. I was talking to Paul about this a few minutes ago. FEMA has actually posted a list of PEP stations just middle of last month, I think, which was just a little bit of a surprise. And I mean, in some ways, somebody might look at that as like a target list, right? I mean, if things are really bad and our country is in terrible, terrible danger, these are the stations that are going to stay on the air and help keep us informed. And, for a long, long time, that's been kind of it hasn't ever been, really been classified, but it's not something that you could just go to the internet and look up. So kind of a surprise, but it's there now. I want to show you a video of a PEP station that was commissioned in Honolulu, because I think it's pretty interesting. You'll see, if you go ahead and run that video, please.
Season officially begins on June 1st. Today, federal and local emergency officials unveiled a critical tool they say everyone should have to stay informed during a disaster. Mark Carpenter has more.
Imagine yourself without those technologies. Your airport is closed. Your shipping lanes are obstructed. You have no way to communicate with each other or with the outside world.
A grim scenario that could quickly become all too real if disaster ever struck. But now the state has another avenue to remain informed as FEMA unveiled a brand new emergency broadcast studio. It sits on the grounds of Kahoiki Village, featuring a full media setup designed to keep transmitting communications through any type of threat.
Everything from tsunamis to earthquakes to tornadoes to hurricanes, man-made attacks such as high-altitude electromagnetic pulse, chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear air particles.
Our mission here was to make sure that we had this capability in place, first, to ensure that the president can communicate with the American public under all conditions, and then secondly, to ensure that our state and local officials know that you have a resource here in your community that can be utilized as a critical communications lifeline when other forms of communication are impacted.
And if needed, it's meant to shelter its operators with basic accommodations and 60 days worth of food and water. It's one of nearly 80 similar FEMA-built facilities across the nation, and it'll broadcast on AM radio, KHKA, CBS 1500.
Text list, opt-in lists, and all these other things, but time and again, those things have a tendency to fail under very adverse circumstances, whether it's a hurricane or significant natural disaster. This facility will stay on the air. It'll help enable Hawaii's broadcasters to continue to communicate to the public in times of disaster.
And hopefully it never has to be used, but when that time comes, it's ready to be a voice for the islands. Mark Carpenter.
So I thought that was, this was, I think, in May of this year. Of course, the FEMA guys are going to launch their, do their christening at the station in Hawaii, right? It was nice they showed us that new miniature AM antenna there.
Is it officially begin?
So that's a big component of what we're doing in Washington to try and ensure that AM stays in radio, AM stays in vehicles. Just make sure everybody knows about the PEP service. And the 60-day thing, that was something that I was not aware of until I saw this video. So it's really a last line of defense type of a thing. One last quick thing I'm going to talk about that NAB's been doing is we've been seeing how AM works in electric vehicles. And there are a lot of electric vehicles. I showed you the slide yesterday when I went to the LA Auto Show. There were 75% of the electric cars had AM in them. We did some tests, and this is a coverage map. The green lines there show where the this is an all-digital signal, was received. And at the edge of coverage there, we made two audio recordings. And I'd like to just go ahead and ask, let's go ahead and play that first audio recording. This is how the analog would sound at that point. And we switched from all digital to analog when we were there so we could make this recording. Okay, now go ahead and write to the second clip, please. So, the big difference. That's great. Stop that. So this was in a gas-powered vehicle, but this is just an illustration of how well the all-digital can work. And we did some, I think I might have taken that slide out for to save a little time, but if you go look for our paper, we've done a couple papers on this in the NEB conference. We found that the all-digital signal is quite robust in the electric vehicle, and we think that AM has a bright future, especially in all vehicles, not just gasoline-powered vehicles. So let's hope that we can get something done on our legislation. So I'll just stop there, Paul. Thanks.
We'll come back to you, David. Thank you. And I'm going to ask David Oxenford to come up next. You met him a few minutes ago, so I won't give you his full introduction, but just emphasize that we're fortunate to have people like David come and invest time in conferences like this because there really aren't that many people that could give the presentation he gave this morning, which synthesizes these interests and issues that are so important to broadcasting in specific. And over time, there have been fewer and fewer of them. So we appreciate him, and you should check out his broadcast law blog. David Oxenford, welcome back. You want to talk over here or your preference?
I can just do it from here. Everybody
great.
Hear me okay?
Great. Yep.
Yeah. So I thought I would talk about the AM in Every Vehicle Act. That's the proposal pending before Congress that would require that AM radio stay in the cars. You know, you really look at this, and it's so surprising that a bill that just started really in March or April of this year already has got such momentum in Congress in Washington, because yeah, it hasn't been passed yet, and we're 6 months down the road. But to even be talked about, even be talking about it possibly passing this year, is just crazy fast for the way things usually work in Washington. And to see the sponsors on the AM in Every Vehicle Act, Ed Markey and Ted Cruz, like the most liberal senator from Massachusetts, to Ted Cruz, one of the more conservative senators from Texas, are the two main co-sponsors on this bill. It spans the political horizon, all in favor of keeping AM in the car. You know, why is this even an issue? As David said, it's, you know, the car makers have talked about this being an issue with digital interference or interference from electric cars to AM radio. In fact, it's probably just the first step for car makers to get recurring revenue. You know, they don't just sell a car anymore. They sell service plans. They sell internet connections. They sell Sirius XM connections. And they get a piece of the action every time they sell one of those subscriptions to go with the car. So it's not just the original sales price where they make their money, it's getting that little bit of a piece of the action as things go along. You guys, over the air, free over the air broadcasting, doesn't give them a piece of the action. And it's not profitable for those stations to be there, for your stations to be there supplanting some of these services that are paying a little bit of money to them each and every month, recurring revenue that goes to the auto manufacturers. So that's, I think, one of the reasons that AM and ultimately FM is imperiled in the vehicles. I rent a lot of cars going around to state broadcast associations, and every one of them, it's a challenge finding the radio. Or once you find it, figuring out how to change stations. Each one is different. Each one is hidden in a different place. Some of them are under audio. Some of them are on the home screen. It's crazy how hard it is. So this AM in Every Vehicle Act is really a way to start making sure that radio is up front. Congress is proposing not that the FCC do anything, but the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration would adopt rules requiring that manufacturers keep AM radio in the car until some substitute service has been certified as having the same reaching 90% of the U.S. population with EAS signals. And an entirely different agency, the Government Accountability Office, the GAO, would have to do that study due 18 months after the effective date of the bill to find out when that alternate service would be available to give local alerts to cars for free to replicate what you're currently getting from broadcasting. Likely not to happen for years. In the interim, car dealers not only have to make AM available with every car that's sold in the United States, but they also have to make it accessible so that people can actually find that radio, not buried under 18 screens that you have to scroll through before you can find it. And it requires AM, not digital AM. There was some concern, I think, that if you went to an all-digital AM, everybody would have to do digital AM in order to be on the car screens, that some of the car dealers would move in that direction. No, it's got to be current analog radio, AM radio, or hybrid radio, AM with the digital component as well, has to be available in the car. This bill is moving forward in Congress. I think we can expect to see something. It seems like this bill actually has legs. Now, there are folks that are lobbying against it. There are concerns by some Congress folks that they don't think that there should be government mandates on auto manufacturers that make the manufacturing process more difficult, even though they supposedly stand behind AM radio. But you know, shoot, there's mandates on car makers for airbags, there's mandates for crumple zones, there's mandates for virtually everything else in the car. Why not require AM radio as well? And that seems to be getting through a lot of congressional representatives. But if you've got the opportunity to talk to any of the Congress folks who haven't signed on to this when they come into your local stations, or if the other folks at your stations have that opportunity when their congressional folks are being interviewed for news stories or others at your station, make sure they get the message about how important this bill is and why it really should be passed.
I want to come back to that topic in just a minute because it's important, obviously. And I want to introduce Chris Tarr. He's the Group Director of Engineering for Magnum Media, which is a family-owned broadcast station, a company based right here in Wisconsin. And he's got a whole bunch of mysterious acronyms after his name. Actually, not mysterious to this group, but it tells me how committed he is to lifelong learning and to participating in our industry through SBE certifications and the SBE mentoring program. And he's been great to work with on Radio World articles where we've cooperated. So, Chris Tarr, welcome.
Thank you. Oh, there we go. Thank you. I'm outgunned up here, clearly. But I want to bring a kind of a, as opposed to a macro view, more of a micro view, Wisconsin, the Midwest, and EAS. That's the next presentation we're going to be doing. As part of my work here in Wisconsin, I am the chairman of the State Emergency Communications Council, working with FEMA and the FCC on things like EAS. And since we've had the AM Revitalization Act, or some could call the AM Owner Revitalization Act, it's done some great things for radio in general. It's kind of questionable with emergency alerting in AM. For example, we had a station not too far from here change your license to go from 23 kilowatts to 250 watts to free up the land to sell somewhere else because they have a big translator and they don't need AM anymore. That's just there to be able to hold the license for the FM. So we're seeing some of that going on nationwide now with some of these changes with AM, which makes it a little bit of a concern with EAS. As we were just speaking, the AM signals reach everywhere. EAS over AM is exceptionally reliable and can be picked up just about everywhere. But the problem is sometimes we get in our own way. I like to call it stepping on rakes. When it comes to this stuff, we come to the table and say, hey, this is important that we keep AM around because of these things. In the same breath, oh yeah, I'm gonna reduce my facilities or get rid of nighttime service so I can take down these towers and sell the land. So one of the things from my perspective in emergency communications is, we need to take a look at the bigger picture here. And I realize that we're a business, we're not a charity. And some of these things, can be expensive to run, or the land can be worth more than the towers that are on it. But we need to ourselves look at the future of AM and realize that it's going to be there. I had a specific situation where I got asked for a waiver there was an AM-FM LP2, and they wanted to move the AM-LP to a co-owned FM. So they had both of their FMs as the LP2s. The reason being they didn't think anybody listened. And they went, well, more people will hear it on our FM station. And after talking for a minute, I said, here's the point. If everybody starts to do that, all of this alerting is going to be gone. We just assume nobody's listening. And, if I issue that waiver to you, then the next person along is going to do the same thing and down the line. And all of a sudden, we're not going to have any alerting on AM because we all assume nobody listens. So, for me, that's an important component to all of this, and not just lip service. We can't go to the FCC or to Congress and go, we're an important cog in this wheel. We're an important way to get your message out when we are essentially not doing ourselves any favors. Now that we have translators, how can we completely get rid of the AM, or at least make it so little that nobody even knows it's there? You listen to the translators. They don't mention the AM frequencies at all. So, from an emergency management standpoint, we need to take care of those things. And not only the promotion of that, but the engineering of that. And I know that very well with all the stations I deal with across the state. There's not a lot of effort going into FM, and nothing kills technology faster than bad implementation. And, we've kind of stopped thinking about the AM because they're pretty straightforward, pretty simple. But how many times have you gone and looked at the program lines or the STL feeds? Or, we had, anecdotally, we bought a station in La Crosse, and it was a graveyard, 1490, your basic just random barter talk programming on an MW1 transmitter that couldn't make more than 60% modulation. And for those of you who are been around a long time, a PCL-505 STL with bad caps in it. This station sounded horrible, but they didn't care. It's like, whatever. We came in, I put in, new STL, new transmitter. We redid all the wiring at the studio. Got the modulation up above 100%. And in two books, we were in the ratings on an AM without an FM playing music. New processing, the whole nine yards. And it did very, very well, and then we sold it. But because I guess it did so well. But that just, again, that's the where we as engineers need to think of those things. And so you know that if there's any emergency messages, people are going to be able to, are going to hear it on that station because that's what they're listening to, and they can hear it because you can hear the audio on that station now, and the coverage is much better. So I guess in short, and again, I'll cover some of this in the next talk that I'm involved in here, that you know, we really have to be champions of this, not just, you know, Paul and David and all these people, you know, because they can do that on a national scale. But if we don't do our jobs and we don't do the right thing, you know, it's going to be a hard sell for them. You know, they can't go to Congress and say, yeah, we need to do AM radio, when on the same token, we don't care. You know, it's just another station that isn't making any money that we just need to deal with. They can make money, and I know that's not really our job, but we can help champion that higher up and say, hey, listen, you know, this can be done, and fairly inexpensively, and we need to do it to serve the community, because when it's not a joke, when all the chips are down, AM radio works. I mean, it just, it's a lot more efficient power-wise. The coverage is much better. So, and believe me, it'll probably get even better with all these stations dropping towers. But but that is what we have to do, is we have to, as engineers, help you know, the people that we work with understand the value of what we're doing, not only for the industry, but for emergency messaging. Because, you know, you don't want to have, the things I always like to tell my coworkers is, you don't want to be the one that has a listener on TV going, well, I didn't hear any alarms coming, you know, as the tornado rips through their house. You don't want to be that station. So, you know, do what you can to make sure that works. And I'll give you some tips in the next session here, specifically with EAS, what we can do. So from a kind of a Wisconsin point of view, that's where I'm coming from.
I want to follow up on that, but first offer, if anyone has a question, and I encourage them, just catch my eye. I'll look out once in a while and put your hand up, and we'll grab it. But Chris, can you expand on this? I think given that this is a technical audience, you're absolutely right that, you know, we should probably focus more on what we can practically do rather than these bigger policy questions in Washington, which are also interesting to me. So what other things, putting EAS aside for a minute, technical things should this audience think about doing on a day-to-day basis that they might not be doing already? What should we change?
Care. Give a crap. I say that flippantly, but it's kind of true. I mean, how many people, when there's a silent sensor goes off, they go, oh, it's just the AM. You know, how many people, when a transmitter goes off the air, oh, I'm not going to worry about it, it's just the AM. Nobody's listening. It really starts with taking pride in what you do and, you know, understanding that AM is a viable service and it requires the same amount of attention as your stream. You know, I very fortunately work with a great group of people who, when I started working with them, said, you know, I don't get it how people have all these alarms on their streams, but their AM's off the air and nobody knows. You know, this is a big part of what they do. So what you can do every day is do what you're best at. You know, look at the audio chains, look at the equipment, keep the site maintained, keep the transmitters maintained. You know, even these new ones, change the filters. You know, anything you can do to make the audio sound better and to make the signal sound better, make sure the brush is cleared out and listen. At least once or twice a day, turn it on, make sure you're on the air. And then I think what happens is that spreads. If you care, other people care. You know, if you walk in and say, yeah, I was over at the AM site today, clearing things out, cleaning things up, you know, making things look good, sounding good, your coworkers start to notice that, and they realize that somebody does care. And if they like you, they know you care, and they'll kind of care about that fact. So I think as a practical matter, just care. Just worry about it.
Yes, sir.
Just real quick, I got a couple texts that came through. First one, this one should be a quicker answer. Roughly how many AM stations are there in the United States? Ballpark.
I'm going to say it's 4,000 something.
Yeah, closer to 5, I think.
Is it closer? David, do you have the recent? They just gave a new
quarterly
update.
Yeah, the numbers just came out last week and was just.
It's been degrading a little bit every quarter now for about 5 years.
But actually, surprisingly slow. It's only reducing each year by about 10 AM stations, and I think it was 4,000 and some that the number came out last week.
I got to believe the translators have something to do with that.
Yes. Well, over the last 20 years,
the numbers of translators has exploded for reasons you're probably all aware of, including AM revitalization, but not just that. Non-com educational FMs have grown a lot in that time span. Commercial FMs have been stable to slightly growing, but the number of AMs have been declining somewhat since translators came in.
Okay, then there's one more for Chris. If the LP stations move to FM, how are they losing AM alerting if the AM will still have to be on the PN? I'm not sure I'm with you on this assertion. Can you make a better case?
Sure. Just 4452 was the number as of last week.
4452. Thank you.
So what my case is that the way that the chain works is by having that diversity of signals. So if all of a sudden everybody were on FM, people listen to AM. They're not going to get those alerts. Now, they may be farther down the chain. Okay, great. But that's not, we all know how well that works sometimes. We all remember the garbage, the dumpster fire that was the first national test. So we know that we can't rely on that daisy chain to work properly all the time. So when we look at, well, if everybody, all the LPs were FMs, we then have no AMs with direct connections farther up the line. They're relying on the daisy chains on the FMs to make this work. So simply from just a diversity of signals. That way, you know, if you've got a station down the line, they could have a monitoring assignment of the AM and the FM, or in some cases, there are places where the AM can be received where the FM can't. And again, so there's that diversity that we have with LP1s and LP2s being on both bands. You could pick up whichever signal comes in better at the place you're at.
I'm going to read you how the car makers responded when that legislation was first introduced and then ask how this group or their management should respond to it. This is the Alliance for Automotive Innovation talking about that legislation. Whether or not AM radio is physically installed in vehicles in the future has no bearing on the various methods of delivering emergency communications that alert the public. This is simply a bill to prop up and give preference to a particular technology that's now competing with other communication options and adapting to changing listenership. They go on to quote FEMA itself, pointing out that the public is moving away from radio and TV as primary channels for news and information. So that's a strong argument. How should broadcasters counter that, whether an engineer or a manager? David Oxenford, thoughts? Or any of you?
I have a thought.
Please.
Well, the first thing, this video is really kind of what put this idea in my head, that when they were talking about how they have 60 days of food and water in the shelter in these PEP stations, if you think about a worst-case situation, nobody wants to think about that. But you know, what do they say? You know, hope for the best, plan for the worst, right? Worst situation is when AM is all that's left. These 60 stations, it's 72. It's 62 AMs and 10 FMs, or the PEP stations, as you can find out by looking at their list. They've all got these hardened facilities. They are it. That is the last line of defense in that situation. And these alternate technologies that the auto people are talking about, they aren't going to help. They aren't going to help in that situation. Everything is gone. There's an AM station that's still got power, and it's still staffed, and it's on the air all the time for 60 days. And this is what I think, this is, the government isn't just trying to plan for normal emergencies, I'll call it, you know, where the daisy chain is important, because society is still intact. But what the government wants to have preparations for is that doomsday scenario, and I don't see any other service besides AM being able to fulfill that.
You also have questions about the reach. I mean, reach right now is 90%.
That's just the PEP stations, too.
Right. But none of the individual audio services have anything near that reach. Even collectively, they don't have that reach. In certain demographics, yeah, there's more listening on a total basis in the younger demographics than to some over-the-air stations, but they, you know, it's only in those particular demographics. And even in those demographics, radio is still accessible and listened to by virtually everybody in those younger demographics. Not only that, but most of these digital services work where there's internet. And there's just not internet every place, especially in emergencies. I mean, that's the first thing that we've seen every time when we had the earthquake in D.C. 10 years ago, the fires in Maui. The first thing that goes down is the cell phone networks, which is where the these alternate services come from. AM doesn't go down.
I will say, first of all, that FEMA never, I don't think, had a big event at the Milwaukee station. I don't know why that is.
You didn't have Lays.
We didn't have Lays, I guess.
Give them.
You know, the other thing I would add too is, if you looked at social media and talked to people after this last national alert, how many people saw people ask how to shut the alerts off? How many people saw messages on, be sure to turn your phone off before 1:20 Central Time? How effective is that? You know, really. I mean, it's a great idea, and it does work. I'm not knocking it, but you know, that's what we're up against here and what people don't, you know, again, it's that whole, you know, the whole Steve Jobs joke where, you know, he gets up on stage and has this revolutionary new device that provides news, weather, and it's free, and it's a radio. You know, everybody thinks of radio as this old technology. Everybody's trying to find the next big thing. And so, okay, cell phones. Everybody's got a cell phone. Great. Cell towers don't always work. And everybody looks at that as their personal device. I am not allowing an alert on there. I don't care what it is. It's my phone. And, you know, it's the government trying to intrude on me and things like that. So what's the backup plan when that happens?
You know, they were having this argument in Congress when they had the hearings on the AM bill. And the one congressman who spoke out against the mandate was a congressman from Eastern Utah. And he talked about how all these great digital services are available to everybody that can substitute for radio. Have you ever driven through Eastern Utah and tried to use your cell phone? It doesn't work. So I don't know how this congressman was saying all these great digital services are there when you can't even get 3G, much less 5G audio anywhere throughout his district.
And you know, one of the provisions in this legislation is exempting all digital as a all digital AM as a you know or, to fulfill as the AM to fulfill that AM requirement, and I was talking to someone about this who thought, well, why were they doing that? And I boiled it down to two things. What AM radio has is it's ubiquitous, and it's simplicity. It's a simple technology. It's more robust. And the all-digital service has neither of those. It's not ubiquitous at this point. There's a, you know, some percentage of car receivers have it, but not nearly enough. And it's certainly not simple. I mean, these digital technologies are the opposite of simple. So,
in our last 10 minutes, I'm going to ask you to answer in rapid-fire succession here. So, brief questions then. Is AM revitalization, the technology initiative at the commission, is that dead? As you pointed out in your previous session, there's been very little progress on these recent issues. Is there anything pending right now, technically, that we should know about that's likely to happen?
It's all pending. I mean, the proposals are on the table to cut back the power of the clear channels, to allow the local stations to increase power, to allow more interference.
Seems to be sitting
but it's
there.
Not moving.
Yeah.
Because, you know, honestly, there's a debate. There's lots of folks who represent the high-powered AM clear-channeled stations who make the good argument that they've got the listening. If you look at AM listening, who's getting the most listening? Probably those stations, including in a lot of the rural areas, including at night, and including in a lot of those areas where David showed stations, you know, service area comes from these 50-kilowatt clear-channel stations.
We might mandate AM, but that's kind of a very, we should, I think of that as the minimum bar, because that's a mandate. How do we get AM back to where it was? Well, it's never going to happen. Maybe not. But here's the thing that I hear from everybody in this room. Content is king, right? So we can all tweak our processors, and we can all fix our infrastructure and make sure our DAs are in alignment, blah, blah, blah. If no one wants the content, they're not going to listen. So is that likely to... Is that just a trend line that's going to continue to diminish, or is there a substantial chance that it could get better? What do we do on the content side?
I think we're making inroads on that. I think that a byproduct of having these FM translators is AM stations playing music, and people are starting to realize that that does work if you have the right format. And I think that what will happen is some of these other AM stations that don't have the component of the translator will see that working. Again, you know, and again, this is anecdotal and it's a one-off. This AM station in La Crosse didn't have an FM component and it played music and it did well. So I think that content is king, and if you can bring something to the table that's unique and interesting, this was an oldies, 50s, 60s oldies format, if you can bring something like that to the table, people will come.
And WWFD is a perfect example of that. That's the first all-digital AM station in the country in Frederick, Maryland, and they have a format, they call it the Gamut, and it's a good format, it's a music format, people like listening to it, and when they went all-digital, they showed up in ratings for the first time. And I think that that's another example of, you know, the content being king. And I wanted to just weigh in. You had a question about the FCC and is something dead at the FCC. And I was just going to say, I think it's hard to tell when something's dead at the FCC. And I have a great AM example. There was a proceeding to allow for AM method of moments analysis on AM antenna patterns rather than having to do real proofs in the field and all. It took 14 years to get that through. And I was, this happened earlier in my NAB career, and it was just amazing to me that something could take that long.
Well, it wasn't cellular, so.
So it's hard, I think, Paul, you know, the inactivity, you don't know. Mm-hmm. You don't know. I would certainly not call it dead. I don't think it's dead as long as there's people like us who are, you know, interested in seeing it move forward and keeping it alive.
Perhaps I'm guilty of making an assumption that the leadership of a given chairmanship affects that, because you see Chairman Pai out there talking, and I don't think I've heard Jessica Rosenwald talk about this at all. So,
One other issue just to keep in mind, there is a proposal in the ownership proceeding to lift all caps on AM ownership, to not restrict local AM ownership. Right. And that could have, if somebody came up with an idea to really revitalize AM and use that spectrum for something, the ability to own as many stations as you want in a particular market to get a particular format or group of formats out there might be a possibility if those ownership rules changed. And it may be that that's the one area the FCC could see relaxation of local ownership.
And it's not universally popular with broadcasters. There
that's
are
right.
some
that's right.
notable
some fear
yeah, right.
that it will be
right.
just ignored.
I should also point out too that we just had a feature in Radio World about how iHeartRadio has been investing money in improving and expanding infrastructure of some major AM market stations. And they, you know, they were actively pursuing me to do that story. They wanted to call attention to that effort, which I pointed out in my column about it. But you know, we cannot just simply say that companies aren't investing. But as you pointed out, I think that idea of it, Chris, it's just the AM. That quote to me was very telling, and I think that's a mindset more than anything else. But it's also ironic to me that I hear people saying the things that you said about AM, about their streams, like, oh, well, it's just the stream. So, you know, these are our assets. We have to protect all of them well. Interference, briefly, is there any reasonable chance that the FCC would improve on the problem of not interference, but noise on the band? I know that there's been some awareness generally of spectrum noise, but I don't hear about it on radio, and it just gets worse and worse. I'm saying no based on this reaction.
I don't know of any current move to do anything.
Okay. It would be a Herculean lift, too, wouldn't it? I mean, because there's so many interfering sources to AM. And they're so entrenched in our society, the Walmart computer power supplies, LED stoplights, LED streetlights. Yeah. You know, it's just so pervasive. It's hard to imagine somebody cracking down on that and
that's the thing, is those rules are in place. And,
yeah.
But, you know, you can't regulate it. It's just, there's so much.
I'm going to ask you to conclude by addressing this. So when we consider the challenges and the habits of listeners, it's very easy to be discouraged on this topic. So can any of you give me a more positive, optimistic thought about what we might expect in AM? Is there reason for optimism here, more than just mandating it, which seems to me to be sort of the least we could hope for? That just feels like a negative to me. I want it to be a positive. Is AM going to be around for 5 or 10 years plus?
I'm encouraged
sitting next to this guy.
Good.
Because hearing, you know, what he has to say about AM stations, being a real broadcaster, you know, and it's got to start from the bottom up like that, I think. I think that's very encouraging.
And the mere fact that we're all talking about it.
Yeah.
I mean, a year ago, we wouldn't have been talking necessarily about AM improvements. That kind of fell off the table. And now everybody, including Congress, is talking about how important AM is.
Yeah.
I'm just encouraged. I've got a room full of people here who I know care about AM. And, you know, as long as it keeps bubbling up to the top, and we just have to set that example.
Yeah. And you pointed out, David, the reaction in Congress and how quickly things have moved in a city where nothing moves fast. And that is a reminder that those people, at least, take it as a given. What? AM radio and cars? This is a no-brainer. So maybe that's the positive note I'm looking for. Gentlemen, thank you very much, and thank you. Good morning.
A few questions.
I had a late question came in. Yes, please.
We got two questions yet from text that we maybe could get to quickly. First one, this is counterproductive probably to the AM PEP argument. Why not make NOAA weather radio part of the PEP system?
NOAA radio, the weather radio. You probably know the most about that.
Yeah, you know, because NOAA isn't really designed for that. In fact, they don't, their messages aren't even true CAP messages. They have their own system. So you could make that, but it's kind of like trying to fit a square peg in a round hole.
Last question. Where has the push to do away with AM radio come from? Who's behind it and why?
Well, that is a very broad question that raises all sorts of things.
I think David hit it earlier when he talked about the automakers seeing revenue potentials.
Yes.
Outside of radio. And you might have seen the news story about General Motors saying they're going to take out the ability to do CarPlay and Android Auto in their next generation electric vehicles. And this is more evidence of just that, and it's because they want to provide the services to listeners, to their car, you know, to the consumers. And they want to charge for it.
And they want to believe AM is weak.
And it's not, you know, it's not an insolvable interference problem. We know that. It's just a question of revenue.
As a wise person once said, stay tuned. Thank you, everybody.
Oh, we got one more.
One more.
Oh, my goodness gracious. We're cutting into Chris's time here. No, this is great. Please.
Yeah, one quick question here. I think it's great there's a movement to mandate AM radio in the cars, but if they're not going to make it usable in respects to a good antenna or the bandwidth, it's useless. For example, I have an Equinox. Yes, it would meet the mandate. It has AM radio, but I can't listen to it. I get a mile from the transmitter and it's gone. The bandwidth is horrible. So if there's no mandate for those other two things, you might as well not put AM in the cars. I mean, the last car that I had that had phenomenal AM reception was a 2005 Ford Explorer. It was awesome. Music sounded great on it. I could hear the iBox sidebands on it if you listen close enough. That's how good the bandwidth was on that. I've never seen anything since that. And I'm not, it's just not the Equinox. I've heard other people say the same thing. So if those two things aren't included in this mandate, I don't think it's going to do any good.
A good commentary.
I believe there's wording in the legislation that talks about, it doesn't establish specifications or anything like that, but it does talk about usability and you know, implementation quality. In kind of general terms.
In fact, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration is supposed to have a rulemaking about the implementation of the rules where it may put in quality standards, because otherwise it's not going to do any good. You know, just like you could put in an airbag that's a balloon and wouldn't do any good, but there are specific standards for airbags.
Thank you.